This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Friday, August the 21st, 2026. As is my custom, we'll start in the World section of today's Monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to start us off from the World section, our first headline reads, "As France investigates abuse at schools, parents ask, how do I protect my kid?" After reports of a series of abuses in after-school programs in Paris, parents across France have been reassessing how they protect their children. The date on this article is August the 20th. It is by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. And the dateline is Paris. Schools had always been something of a sanctuary for Delphine. The French mother of two says she had total confidence when she dropped off her 5-year-old son at preschool. That is, until she found out that several of his after-school instructors had been accused of abuse, both physical and sexual. "School is supposed to be a safe place," says Delphine, who asked to use a pseudonym because, like other parents interviewed for this article, she worries about a backlash from teaching staff at her son's school. In May, the Paris Public Prosecutor's Office announced that dozens of preschools, elementary schools, and daycares are under investigation on suspicion of violence against children. Since the beginning of 2026, Paris City Hall has suspended 132 of its 14,000 after-school teachers, nearly half of those involving suspected sexual assault, compared with 46 for all of last year. The crisis within Paris public schools is just one of several recent high-profile cases involving violence against minors in France in the past 6 months that have shaken the confidence of parents, including the killing of an 11-year-old girl in May. In a country that prides itself on its affordable and accessible after-school care for working parents, a system so embedded in the work-life culture that 89% of children utilize périscolaire in some form, parents have taken to the streets in protest. This summer, Paris City Hall has seen a 13% drop in camp signups. As parents look to the start of the new school year, many are demanding action from the state and their local schools to protect the estimated 5 million children who rely on the system for after-school care or holiday breaks. The allegations have fueled a larger debate in French society over how to stop violence against minors and salvage trust in the public programs that families depend on. It is good to talk about things to make the issues of violence against children more visible, says Michel Delage, a psychiatrist and family therapist based in Toulon, France. But it needs to lead to actual change in the way things work. Parents are losing faith in the system. The number of reported cases of violence against children has risen steadily since 2016 by 7% each year between 2016 and 2023, according to the Interior Ministry. Such cases, combined with headlines like those about 11-year-old Lihana, who prosecutors say was sexually assaulted and killed by the father of her close friend after school, have compounded perceptions by parents that kids aren't safe. "Our society is in the midst of a crisis, and it has become unbearable," says Philippe Fabry, an independent social worker in the Paris region. "It does start to feel like no one cares about the rights of children." The public has put much of the blame on the French justice system, which has been accused of slow processing times and inefficiency. Earlier in the spring, parents were calling for the ouster of the justice minister. Parents also fault a system that makes it easy to point fingers. In France, after-school programming is run by city halls, separate from the national education system in which teachers are hired after years-long study. After-school instructors can be hired in a matter of weeks. At some schools, such as the one attended by Delphine's son, teachers have been advised to distance themselves from the périscolaire staff. "That approach is very French," says Dr. Delage. "Each French institution is divided and separated by what it does specifically," he says. "There is no communication between one another." Parents say this distracts from the solution. Everyone is saying it's not my fault, it's their fault, says Anne, the mother of a 4-year-old in the Paris suburbs. We're talking about the future of our children here. Recently, Anne watched a video that has been making the rounds on social media showing children what is considered appropriate and inappropriate touch. She never sent her daughter to many friends' houses before, and she's even less inclined to do so now. Sleepovers are, for now, out of the question. I don't want my daughter to be afraid of life, says Anne, but after Lihana's killing, I definitely think twice before sending her to someone's home. Parents are also reconsidering deeply cherished personal privacy laws. Today, cameras can only be used in certain areas of school grounds, if they are used at all, and remain a rarity inside elementary schools. However, legal experts say that if, for example, a school or public building deems that installing surveillance cameras is in the community's best interest, it would not need to ask for the public's approval first. We're seeing a multiplication of demands for cameras in cars, in private homes, and at City Hall, says Gael Mahe, a lawyer at the digital and intellectual property law firm Haas Avocats in Paris. People are looking for protection. Some people also want to be able to say, I didn't do anything. Look at the video. Many parents say that police officers need more training on how to handle complaints involving violence against minors. There is still a stereotype that the parent who raises the alarm is annoying, says Nicoleta Pitar, mother of an elementary schooler. Since Ms. Pitar says she doesn't want to change her daughter's entire life because of a few criminal... Still, Ms. Pitar says she doesn't want to change her daughter's entire life because of a few criminal cases. She decided to keep her in the after-school program and still sends her to sleepaway camp. I'm disgusted by what's happening, says Ms. Pitar, but making children scared of everything is not going to help them. Today, Delphine is focused on teaching her children what is right and wrong. She's on the PTA at her son's preschool and recently attended a protest at the Place Vendôme in support of children's rights. Her son's preschool has also opened a phone line for parents to call in to get support. That has helped. As parents, it's hard to know what to say, says Delphine. It's not that some things aren't nice to do or to say to kids, it's that they're forbidden. We need to tell them this, all the while remaining light about it. And once again, this particular article was by Colette Davidson, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline from today's World section of The Monitor, this one reads, On the Youngest Continent in the World, A Push for More Kid-Friendly Cities. Africa is the fastest urbanizing region on the planet. A growing movement of planners and parents wants to make its cities safe and fun for children. The date on this article is August the 20th. It is by Ryan Lenora Brown, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor, and Harriet Akinyi, who is a contributor at The Monitor. The datelines are Johannesburg, South Africa, and Nairobi, Kenya. Penina Ndigwa spent years studying urban planning, but one of her most instructive moments in the field occurred far from a classroom. In 2018, she was walking through downtown Nairobi with her baby strapped to her back when suddenly and urgently her daughter needed a diaper change. Miss Ndigwa scanned the streets around her, but there was nowhere to go. No clean public toilets, no public changing stations. That was an awakening, Ms. Ndegwa says. She realized that her city wasn't built with her or her child in mind. That is a problem of continental proportions. Sub-Saharan Africa has both the most rapidly urbanizing population on Earth and the youngest. By 2050, 1 in 4 people on the planet will be African, and 2/3 of them, about 1.4 billion people, will live in urban areas. But although nearly half of the region's population is under age 18, its cities are often unfriendly places to grow up, crowded, poorly planned, and unsafe. Fixing that, many say, should be an urgent priority. If cities are safe for children, they are safe for everyone, says Ms. Ndigwa, who now runs a social enterprise focused on child-friendly city planning called Wow Mom Kenya. Designing cities through a child's lens meets everybody's needs. Ms. Ndegwa's experience of scrambling to find a changing station led her to approach the city government of Nairobi and work with officials there to install diaper changing stations in public toilets and markets. But when she began to take the changing stations to those crowded, noisy markets, she quickly saw a bigger problem. The reason there were so many children there to begin with was because their mothers, who worked as hawkers, had nowhere else to leave them. I saw babies laid on cartons in tiny rooms next to toilets, Ms. Ndigwa recalls. It was shocking. Her next project was born, and she began setting up daycares in markets across the city. For trader Winnie Goroge, having access to such a space has been so transformative that she travels 25 miles each day to hawk stationery in a downtown market instead of in the neighborhood where she lives. One of the hardest things for us is to find a safe place where we can leave our children, she explains. Where I live, the apartment has no space for children to play. We live close to the road, and it's unsafe for them to be outside. For decades, the conventional wisdom has held that cities are objectively better places for the world's children to grow up in than rural areas, what experts call the urban advantage. The argument is simple. Urban areas have more of nearly everything, from schools and hospitals to jobs and infrastructure. But the unplanned sprawl of African cities is poking holes in that theory. For those who live in planned neighborhoods who have adequate housing, cities are still usually better, says Sarah Sabri, founding chair of the Cities for Children Alliance and the global lead for urban issues at Save the Children. But if you look at the conditions that many children in these cities live in, it's clear why urban life is not always better. For instance, more than half of African cities live in slums. For instance, more than half of African city dwellers live in slums, meaning their homes are impermanent, overcrowded, and often without easy access to water and toilets. In at least 10 African countries, that number tops 70%, and in Mali and South Sudan, it is more than 90%. Evans Otino knows firsthand that these neighborhoods are hard places to grow up. 8 miles from central Nairobi, the air over Dandora landfill is gauzy with the acrid chemical smoke of burning garbage. The city's largest dump borders a densely populated neighborhood of modest concrete homes and apartment blocks with small shops woven into the spaces between them. It was here that Mr. Otieno spent his childhood. Orphaned at the age of 6, he ended up joining one of the area's notorious gangs, which fight violent battles for control of the landfill. After nearly being killed during a robbery in 2009, Mr. Otieno decided he wanted out, and he began considering what had pushed him to join the gang in the first place. Peer pressure, crime, and unsafe environments shaped my daily life, he says. When he looked across his neighborhood, he was struck by how few places there were for kids to go, almost no playgrounds, parks, libraries, or sports fields. He thought of how his own childhood might have turned out differently if he had access to safe play spaces. Growing up here was dangerous, he says. The unsafe environment shaped daily life and pushed him toward the gang, he believed, because it was the only place he felt secure. For children, playing is fundamental, says Anna Claudia Rosbach, executive director of UN Habitat. Not only a source of entertainment, play is also central to how children learn to navigate the world, from developing their motor skills to teaching them how to interact with their peers. And if kids don't have ready-made spaces to play, they create them, she says. So along Dandora's drainage channels and on the edges of busy roads, children improvise. After school hours, makeshift football pitches appear suddenly on dusty patches of land, while small clearings and undeveloped plots become informal playgrounds. Many children in our community grew up without dignity, but green spaces can change that. They give children a place to feel like children, a place where they can play, interact, and enjoy life in a safe, positive environment, says Mr. Otieno. In 2014, Mr. Otieno founded a small community organization called the Believers Transformation League. His team began clearing out an informal dump site, eventually transforming it into a community garden. More gardens followed, and recently the organization inaugurated the Dandora Community Park, which hosts several sports fields and a children's arena. For Princess Adhiambo, a high school student and soccer fanatic, having access to a soccer pitch for the first time has been life-changing. "I'm so happy because I can develop my talent," she says. Ms. Sabri of Cities for Children views stories like Mr. Otieno's as a reminder that while the challenge of making African cities better for children are enormous, they are not insurmountable. If governments would use the energy that so many young Africans have, there would be a million positive things happening in a very short time, she says. She also sees hope in the fact that the African cities of the future are, in many ways, a clean slate. The United Nations estimates that of all the urban areas in the world that will exist in 2050, more than half have yet to be built. "We have to start by fixing what isn't working now," she says, "but then, going forward, we can start fresh." And once again, this particular article was by Ryan Lenora Brown, was a special correspondent at The Monitor, and Harriet Akinyi, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Continuing on, still in the world section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, "Why promised U.S. breakthroughs in the Middle East failed to materialize." American diplomatic efforts to create, quote, historic breakthroughs in Iran and Gaza appear to have stalled. The date on this article is August the 19th. It is by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor, and the dateline is London. This should have been a banner week for American diplomacy in the Middle East, highlighting what U.S. President Donald Trump trumpeted as a, quote, historic breakthroughs in ending the Iran war and the Israel-Hamas conflict in Gaza. But events on the ground told a very different story. Intended milestone moments on both diplomatic fronts failed to materialize. Both conflicts, while showing no immediate sign of reigniting into full-scale wars, continued to flare up. Iran, Hamas, and Israel all reiterated their steep preconditions for buying into the U.S. peace plans. And the negotiating logjam was more than just an unwelcome contrast with the lofty claims Mr. Trump has made for his diplomatic deals. It challenged a fundamental long-term goal of his presidency, dialing back America's decades-long focus on the Middle East and shifting it eastward toward China. Avoiding, in the words of his formal national security strategy, the, quote, forever wars that bogged us down in that region at great cost. The U.S.-Israel attack on Iran in late February has not yet turned into a forever war, but a conflict Mr. Trump initially described as a few weeks' excursion is now in its sixth month. It's also been 2 months since a memorandum of understanding to end it was drawn up with Tehran. At the time, the memorandum was hailed by the White House as a, quote, historic breakthrough. Quote, forged through decisive American strength, this agreement ensures Iran will never obtain a nuclear weapon, reopens the Strait of Hormuz to free navigation, and puts America first, rejecting failed policies of appeasement and endless wars that have weakened the United States for decades. The agreement fell apart in July, and Iran resumed attacks against commercial vessels transiting the Strait of Hormuz, insisting that the memorandum's vague wording recognized its control of the key waterway. Mr. Trump then briefly ordered a resumption of U.S. airstrikes. But Iran continues to mount sporadic attacks against shipping, and assert its claim over the strait. This past Monday was the target date set in the memorandum for reaching a comprehensive peace, free navigation, and denuclearization agreement with the Iranians, and it passed without official comment. On Tuesday, Mr. Trump said there were, quote, no talks or conversations going on or scheduled. Still, with efforts to end the Iran war bloc, the president had clearly hoped that this week would bring more encouraging news on the other Middle East conflict he's striving to resolve, Israel's campaign in Gaza against Hamas, the Iranian-supported Islamist group behind the October 7, 2023 murder and abduction of hundreds of Israelis. His Gaza disarmament, reconstruction, and development plan was first unveiled in September 2025 as part of a diplomatic initiative with two clear early successes, ending the full-scale Gaza war and securing the release of Israeli hostages. But for months after that, the Board of Peace he set up under his chairmanship to implement the plan made no visible progress on its key provisions, the decommissioning of Hamas's arms, a pullback of Israeli forces, and a transfer of control to Palestinian technocrats backed by an international security force. Then, at the end of last month, that appeared to change. Quote, the Board of Peace reached a historic agreement for the complete disarmament of Hamas and all other armed groups in Gaza, the president declared on his Truth Social platform. He'd called the deal, quote, a monumental step toward lasting peace and security and an amazing development that everybody said could never be achieved. That set the stage for follow-up talks this week and a potentially more encouraging counterpoint to the diplomatic stalemate on Iran. Mr. Trump's envoy, Jared Kushner, led a Board of Peace delegation in talks with Hamas in Cairo on Sunday and met Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Monday. Hamas had indeed accepted the disarmament provision under pressure from key regional players Egypt, Turkey, and Qatar. But Hamas officials were reportedly conditioning acceptance on Israel's fulfillment of the October 2025 ceasefire terms. Israel, instead of gradually pulling back from the roughly 50% of Gaza it held, has since expanded its reach. It has also continued to launch airstrikes targeting what it says are Hamas members and claiming hundreds of lives. This week's talks in Israel did make some progress. The prime minister had initially rejected the latest 15-point disarmament and withdrawal blueprint outright, saying Israeli forces would stay put until Hamas was fully and finally disarmed. Mr. Kushner managed to get the Israeli leader to leave open the prospect of an eventual move forward. Working groups were agreed to examine ways forward on demilitarization as well as on sanitation infrastructure in war-devastated Gaza. Yet Mr. Netanyahu's immediate focus is on Israel's national election in October. With polls showing most Israelis want him out, he's unlikely to soften his stand on Hamas disarmament, something even many of his opponents support. Nor does he appear inclined to rein in Israel's military operations. The day after his talks with Mr. Kushner, Israeli aircraft attacked a cafe near Gaza's Mediterranean coast, targeting a Hamas member who the military said had participated in the October 2023 attacks. It left six other people dead and injured, more than a dozen. And again, this particular article is by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. And here's one final article from today's World section of The Monitor. The headline reads, "Signs mount that Russians are losing patience with Kremlin's war with Ukraine." The banning of Russia's Yabloko party from upcoming elections may hint that public anti-war sentiments are larger than the Kremlin is comfortable with. The date on this article is August the 19th. It is by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. And the dateline is Moscow. When Russia's Supreme Court on Monday upheld the controversial decision to bar the liberal Yabloko party from running any candidates in next month's elections for the State Duma, it focused on alleged infractions of electoral legislation. But it didn't seem coincidental that the removal of Yabloko, which has participated in every federal election since 1993, will eliminate the only voice that explicitly opposes the war in Ukraine. That means Russian voters won't be able to express anti-war sentiments via their ballots. The decision is, quote, a self-exposure of the political system, says Yabloko's venerable founder, Grigory Yavlinsky. It is obvious that the demand for peace and freedom has turned out to be much stronger today than the authorities expected. As the war escalates with a new generation of Ukrainian drones striking deep into Russia's heartland, destroying oil refineries and laying waste to consumer distribution centers, Russians are finding it increasingly difficult to ignore or treat as a distant inconvenience. Like Mr. Yavlinsky, Western analysts have speculated that the arrival of war's destructive realities on their own doorstep might cause public patience to wear thin, or that the growing costs and economic strains will lead Russia's elites to press the Kremlin to end the conflict. Ukrainian experts say the logic of hitting largely consumer targets is in part retribution for analogous Russian attacks, and that disrupted supply chains affected the military as well. But the hope that rising public pain might stimulate anti-war sentiment and activism is clearly part of Kyiv's calculation. In his evening address on August 14th, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky noted that every level of pressure on Russia must bring that country, above all its society, closer to wanting to end their war. Gauging Russian public opinion can be difficult, particularly under war conditions, but some are still trying to do it. Amid the intensified Ukrainian drone assault in July, over 70% of respondents to a survey conducted by the Levada Center, Russia's only independent polling agency, continued to support Russian forces in Ukraine, but almost two-thirds wanted to see peace negotiations. However, only a quarter approved of making concessions to Ukraine and the West to reach peace, and half backed more assertive military action to bring Ukraine to the table. Half said they believe the Russian army is achieving its war goals, while about a third thought it is not winning. The strains have been with us for a long time, and now we have these drone attacks, says Kirill Poputnikov, an architect in Yaroslavl, a city 160 miles northeast of Moscow that has seen multiple drone attacks, including early August strikes on a local refinery that caused massive fires and sent up thick clouds of black smoke. If life were normal, then fuel shortages and such might make you feel panic. But with all this going on, it's just another irritating thing. In a July survey of Russians by the Levada Center, 57% of respondents assessed the political situation in the country as tense, an increase of 10% in just over a year. Only 1 in 4 described the situation as calm, a decrease of 14% since last year. Another Levada poll reports that one of the most basic measures of public well-being, what sometimes called the happiness index, has fallen to near record lows, with just 47% of respondents saying that they are, on balance, satisfied with their lives. Sociologists say that Russians generally tell pollsters that they're happy as long as things are basically okay with health, family, and income. Perhaps the hardest-hit social sector is the small business community, which was already in deep economic distress due to rising taxes, high interest rates, and falling consumer demand, even before Ukrainian drones targeted critical warehouse hubs. Kyiv's war planners appear to have singled out the online retailer Wildberries, often described as Russia's version of Amazon. Since July, they have destroyed an estimated 25% of its storage facilities, hitting sites as far away as the Ural city of Yekaterinburg, 1,250 miles from Ukraine's border, and destroying billions of dollars worth of merchandise. Lev Gudkov, scientific director of the Levada Center, says the mood among Russia's approximately 7 million small business people is one of pessimism and hopelessness. Many of them rely on Wildberries and its main competitor, Ozon, and the online national reach they provide to bring their goods to market. Some have seen their inventories literally go up in smoke, and despite promises of compensation, many are facing imminent bankruptcy. Trust in all branches of power, the government, the Duma, and to a lesser extent, the president, is falling, Mr. Gudkov says. Margareta Zvadaskaya, an expert with the Finnish Institute of International Affairs in Helsinki, says that even beleaguered small business people are unlikely to panic, but, judging by past behavior, they will probably hunker down and find ways to survive, hoping that things will get better. We shouldn't expect a mass flight of entrepreneurs from business, but more cautious behavior, she says. They can cut investment and hiring, keep more cash on hand, diversify warehouses and suppliers. These are the kinds of actions they take when times get bad. And once again, this particular article was by Fred Weir, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up our first headline, which reads, "Is Washington awash in self-dealing? If Democrats win the House, oversight will rise." President Donald Trump has asserted that, quote, nobody cares if he and his family are making big money during his presidency. But some voters in his own party say ethical standards have declined, and midterm elections might allow Democrats to put new scrutiny on the issue. The date on this article is August the 21st. It is by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. One of the most persistent criticisms of President Donald Trump has to do with his vast and growing personal fortune and that of his family members and associates. Nearly every week, it seems, new Trump money-making ventures come to light, triggering cries of conflict of interest and of profiting off the presidency, even if the ventures are technically legal. Last week, for example, news broke that a Trump-appointed regulator had granted preliminary approval for the Trump-affiliated cryptocurrency business World Liberty Financial to receive a federal charter as a bank. Earlier this month, the company that runs Mr. Trump's social media platform, Truth Social, rolled out an up to $100,000 a month subscription service granting early access to the president's posts, which have the potential to move financial markets. The service faces a federal lawsuit alleging it violates constitutional rights to equal access. Even the small stuff counts. From sneakers and fragrances to kitchenware and spa towels, new merchandise in the online Trump store brings in millions of dollars a year, according to the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. So far, Democrats have had little recourse but to complain over what they see as unethical or at least unseemly presidential profit-making, unlike any in American history. The party controls no branches of government. But as the November midterm elections fast approach, that could soon change. With Democrats favored to win a majority in the House and potentially even the Senate, the party stands to gain control of committees and the subpoena power that comes with it. In theory, a Democratic Congress could even impeach Mr. Trump again, though as of now, there's little appetite for that, key White House Democrats say. Some believe the last impeachment backfired politically. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, told MS Now recently that a new Democratic majority in Congress would focus on investigating Mr. Trump and allies, holding them accountable for every gift and ripoff using the power of the subpoena. In addition to the crypto ventures, Mr. Raskin cited controversial presidential pardons and allegations of pay-to-play and the nearly $1.8 billion federal weaponization fund Mr. Trump has tried to create to compensate people claiming to be victims of government overreach. Crypto, in particular, would likely be a major focus of hearings, with Democrats seeking to compel testimony from witnesses both inside and outside government, as well as access to relevant documents. For Mr. Trump and his allies, the potential danger comes not only in what is said under oath in a congressional hearing room, but also any information that could provide legal fodder for accountability outside of Congress. In 2025 alone, the president earned $1.4 billion just from crypto, out of an overall annual income for the year topping $2 billion, according to the financial disclosure form released July 1. Mr. Trump's net worth topped $6 billion, Forbes reports, most of it accrued during his second term and the 2024 campaign cycle. In the upper chamber, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, the top Democrat on the Senate Banking Committee, is leading the charge against World Liberty Financial's efforts to receive a full charter as a, quote, trust bank from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the bank regulatory arm of the Treasury Department. This is the most brazen act of self-dealing our financial system has ever seen, Senator Warren wrote on X on August 14th. I'm introducing a bill to stop this kind of unprecedented corruption. World Liberty Financial's management includes the president's sons and the son of Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. The president himself holds the title of chief crypto advocate. Throughout most of American history, presidents have sought to avoid appearances of conflict of interest as a matter of course. Jimmy Carter transferred control of his family peanut business to a trustee. Many presidents, including Ronald Reagan, both George Bush's and Bill Clinton, put their assets in a blind trust. Mr. Trump has taken a different approach. For both of his presidencies, he retained ownership of the family real estate business, the Trump Organization, but handed day-to-day management to his two older sons. Business transactions involving foreign governments, be it licensing agreements for overseas project or simply overnight stays in Trump hotels by foreign delegations, have elicited cries of conflict of interest and charges of unconstitutional behavior as a violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause. Kimberly Benza, spokesperson for the Trump Organization, said in a written statement that it operates separately from the presidency and complies with ethics and conflict of interest laws. The company, she said, has put in place a comprehensive set of internal ethical standards and has an independent outside ethics advisor to ensure continued transparency, uphold the highest standards of integrity, and avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law, is also deeply involved in overseas business ventures, even as he serves as a special envoy for peace missions, negotiating with governments in countries where he has investments, alongside Mr. Witkoff. Mr. Kushner's company, too, denies conflicts of interest. Both Mr. Kushner and Mr. Witkoff serve Mr. Trump as volunteers, and so they are not subject to government ethics rules. The president and vice president, too, have long been exempt from the federal criminal conflict of interest statute known as 18 U.S.C. Section 208, enacted in 1962. Lawmakers had feared that forcing divestment or recusal could interfere with a president's ability to carry out constitutional duties and that political pressure would serve as enough of a check. Ironically, what has happened is, in some ways, lower-level federal employees are subject to stricter ethics rules and laws than the president and the vice president, says Margaret Dylas-Eukins, senior legal counsel on ethics at the nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center. The reliance on norms clearly no longer holds water. Add to the mix the Supreme Court's landmark 2024 ruling granting the president substantial immunity from persecution while in office. Mr. Trump has also retained immunity from tax audits on past returns for himself, his sons, and the Trump Organization as part of the settlement of his lawsuit against the IRS over his leaked tax returns. A federal judge ruled in July that the lawsuit was improper. Mr. Trump has appealed. Other presidents have triggered ethical alarms. On his last day in office, President Clinton famously pardoned fugitive financier Mark Rich after Mr. Rich's ex-wife donated $450,000 to the Clinton $450,000 to the Clinton Presidential Library. President Joe Biden, too, issued controversial pardons late in his term, including to his brothers and to his son Hunter, all of whom had a history of controversial financial dealings that appeared to trade on the family name. But Mr. Trump's flouting of ethical norms is taking place on an unprecedented scale as he reaps massive financial gains while serving as president. In his first term, Mr. Trump was more reserved about business dealings, but upon his return to office last year, he realized he could make big money as president without repercussions, he told the New York Times in January. "I found out that nobody cared," Mr. Trump said. With the president's freewheeling approach to business and public service matters to voters in November, Mr. Trump himself won't be on the ballot, but his congressional allies will. Historically, a second-term president's party does poorly in the midterms. Mr. Trump's job approval ratings have been steadily sinking and are now in the mid-30s. That might be more attributable to dissatisfaction with the cost of living and the Iran war. But polling by the Pew Research Center points to unhappiness over ethics in Trump 2.0, even among the president's supporters. In January 2025, with Mr. Trump back in office, 59% of Republicans said they expected the level of ethics would rise, according to Pew. By April 2026, Pew found only 37% of Republicans and Republican-leaning voters said ethics had risen under Mr. Trump, while 23% said they had fallen. And once again, this particular article was by Linda Feldman, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our next headline from the USA section of today's Monitor, it reads, FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, considers cuts to funds for Internet access at schools and libraries. A program called E-Rate has helped expand public Internet access for 30 years. As the Federal Communications Commission challenges whether the subsidies are still needed, schools and libraries say cuts could leave them with hard choices. The date on this article is August the 20th. It is by Aaron Glantz, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Public schools and libraries across the United States could face steep increases in the prices they pay for Internet service following a review being launched by the Federal Communications Commission. More than 100,000 schools and 11,000 libraries rely on the program known as E-Rate, which has provided discounts of between 20 and 90% for 3 decades, thanks to a 1996 law passed by Congress that mandates telecom providers subsidize universal access. About 47 million students and library patrons depend on this access for connectivity, according to a congressional research service. But in a notice for public comment filed this week, the FCC cited increased concern about the impact excessive screen time is having on children and suggested that it might be time to end subsidies for school and library-based broadband and Wi-Fi services. The commission also said the Internet is so widely available that subsidies might no longer be necessary. At what point should policymakers conclude that the program's core objective has been achieved, it asked. The move is vigorously opposed by the School Superintendents Association and the American Library Association, which implored its members to weigh in. If funding is eliminated or reduced, libraries across the country could face difficult choices between maintaining Internet access and funding other essential services, the Library Association said in an email blast to its members. Jamar Rahming, CEO of the Cuyahoga County Public Library, a 27-branch system outside Cleveland, says a reduction of subsidies could jeopardize digital access that allows residents to apply for jobs, join telehealth medical appointments, and video chat with relatives overseas. The change could also imperil library programs that train workers in the use of artificial intelligence, which have become critical in a region hard hit by the loss of blue-collar jobs, Mr. Rahming says. roughly 250 miles away in Lansing, Michigan, Cheryl Knox, the technology director of the Capital Area District Libraries, a 14-branch system that serves 244,000 people in both urban and rural areas, said a rollback of subsidies could lead her system to cut back on mobile hotspots that allow residents without high-speed internet to watch streaming movies and listen to audiobooks at home. Changes could also raise the administrative costs. Everything runs through the internet, Ms. Knox said. All patron records, the library catalog, where when someone places a hold that's on your server. If we have to pay more for that, it's less for everything else. The $2.5 billion annual support provided to schools and libraries is covered by fees paid by telecommunications companies. The subsidy has long been a target of President Trump's inner circle. Last year, the America First Legal Foundation, founded by White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, filed an amicus brief in a failed legal challenge that asked the Supreme Court to rule E-rate unconstitutional. In the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, widely viewed to be the Trump administration's policy framework, now FCC Chairman Brendan Carr wrote it was time to end wasteful broadband spending policies. Innovations such as low-orbit satellite services from Starlink and Amazon counsel in favor of eliminating many of the heavy-handed FCC regulations, Mr. Carr wrote in a chapter that targeted universal service requirements. In its request for public comment this week, the FCC laid out a number of possibilities, including restricting internet subsidies to rural schools and libraries, excluding areas with larger tax bases, or eliminating subsidies entirely. Any of these changes would mean massive cuts to large urban school districts. $360 million was committed to the New York City Department of Education from 2021 to 2025, with $202 million designated to the Los Angeles Unified School District, according to the School Superintendents Association. Mr. Carr has called for a top-to-bottom review. Because E-rate was created by Congress, any major changes could face a legal challenge. The split is not entirely partisan. Last year, a long list of Republican lawmakers, including Senators Deb Fischer of Nebraska, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Roger Marshall of Kansas, and Mike Crapo of Idaho, joined Democratic colleagues in defending the program in an amicus brief filed before the Supreme Court. The world is more interconnected than ever, making consistent and reliable access to communication services a necessity for full participation in society, the lawmakers wrote. The FCC's deadline for public comment is October 13th, setting up a process that could lead to new rules early next year. And once again, this particular article was by Aaron Glantz, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. And moving on to our next headline, still in the USA section of today's Monitor, this one reads, "Polling in primaries has always been sketchy. This year seems worse." Polling misses have been common and sometimes egregious during the current primary season. This has a real impact on campaigns as polls shape media coverage, affect fundraising, and give cues to candidates honing their positions. The date on this article is August the 20th. It is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Pre-election polls were wide of the mark in two closely watched Democratic primaries this month in Michigan and Wisconsin. In both races, polling showed progressive candidates leading by large margins, but the results proved much closer. In Michigan, former public health official Abdul El-Sayed only narrowly defeated Representative Haley Stevens to win the party's nomination for an open U.S. Senate seat. In Wisconsin, left-wing state lawmaker Francesca Hong wound up losing the gubernatorial primary by a razor-thin margin to David Crowley, a moderate who runs Milwaukee County, Wisconsin's largest municipality. Many of the polls that forecast blowout victories for Mr. El-Sayed and Ms. Hong were internal surveys that partisan groups selectively released. But independent polls also failed to predict the outcomes, raising questions about how reliable election polls are and whether certain voters are being overlooked. Problems with polling aren't new. But the challenges have grown amid an evolving information landscape in which many people no longer own landlines or answer calls from unknown numbers. This electoral cycle even included a purported pollster who admitted to conducting no actual polling after promoting a fraudulent survey, one which Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass cited in a now-deleted tweet. Polling misses are particularly common in primaries, which have become increasingly important at a time when most House seats aren't competitive in the general election. What happens in Wisconsin and Michigan, as well as in Minnesota's U.S. Senate primaries, is what often happens. Polls offered a pre-election snapshot that didn't predict the outcome of complex late-breaking races. The average polling error in statewide primaries is 13 percentage points, according to an analysis by 50+1, a political polling website that analyzed 87 Senate and gubernatorial races held in 2014, 2016, and 2024. One in 10 of these races had an error rate of around 20 points. By comparison, polls taken in the 2 weeks before the 2024 presidential election averaged within 3.3 percentage points of the results, according to the American Association for Public Opinion Research. In 2016 and 2020, the average error was above 5 points. In primaries, you're dealing with much greater unknowns, says Lee Miringoff, who directs the Marist University Institute for Public Opinion, which conducts surveys for national news organizations. The share of undecided voters is higher, more candidates might be involved, and turnout is harder to model. And in states such as Michigan and Wisconsin, being open to voters regardless of party affiliation makes it even more treacherous, he adds. Tom Jensen, who runs public policy polling in Raleigh, North Carolina, agrees. It's much easier to poll in general elections where 90% of people's preferences are already baked in, he says. That allows pollsters to concentrate on surveying swing voters and those who don't vote regularly but can tip close races. But polling misses in primaries can have a real impact on the races. Polls shape media coverage of candidates and affect their ability to raise money by casting them as viable or not in the eyes of donors. In presidential primaries, they set expectations and determine how results are spun and who has momentum. Candidates also rely on internal polls to hone their positions on issues and build coalitions. In Maine, where Republican Senator Susan Collins is seeking a sixth term, Democrat Graham Platner was forced to withdraw in July over sexual assault allegations which emerged after winning his party's nomination. Earlier in the year, he had been dogged by scandals over his past behavior. Favorable internal polls released by his ally suggested, however, that he remained viable and that his primary opponent at the time, Democratic Governor Janet Mills, had no path to victory. Critics have noted that a dearth of public polls made it much harder to challenge the spin from his campaign and to scrutinize his candidacy. Candidates conduct polls for strategic purposes, and they only release information for strategic purposes, says Michael Traugott, a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan who studied political campaigns and how they communicate. This is why we have independent polls, says Dr. Miringoff, a former president of the National Council of Public Polls. News organizations began commissioning pre-election polls in the 1950s so that they weren't reliant on polls released by campaigns. They felt the public had to have their own source of independent information, he said. Today, shrinking news budgets have made that practice more difficult to sustain, particularly for local newspapers and TV stations. Finding voters willing to talk to pollsters is also harder. Good polling has become very expensive, says Dr. Miringoff. The void is often filled by online surveys that are seen as less reliable. Even the most rigorous pollsters struggled to keep up with Wisconsin's roller coaster Democratic primary. Ms. Hong, the progressive state lawmaker, held a big lead in virtually every poll taken before the final weeks of the campaign, albeit with a large share of undecided voters. In July, Ms. Crowley dropped out of the race, Mr. Crowley dropped out of the race because of his low polling numbers and endorsed another candidate, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez. When her candidacy unraveled, Mr. Crowley jumped back in, even as early voters were already casting ballots for Ms. Rodriguez and other candidates. Ms. Crowley's only path to beating Ms. Hong was to mop up all the voters who preferred a more moderate nominee. In the end, that's what happened, says Mr. Jensen, who conducted a poll in early August for Mr. Crowley that showed him closing the gap among those most likely to cast a ballot. Then there was a huge surge in the final week when everyone had stopped polling, he says. The previous polls shaped a narrative of Ms. Hong's unstoppable victory, but people often don't know who they're going to vote for in a primary until the last second, said Mr. Jensen. In Wisconsin and Michigan, polls also overestimated the number of progressive Democrats casting ballots and underestimated those who preferred more moderate candidates, including older voters who were more difficult to survey online. That made tight races look like easy wins for progressive and, say critics, failed to reflect the makeup of the Democratic base. The polling error in Minnesota's Senate primary ran the other direction. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, the more progressive candidate, defeated U.S. Representative Angie Craig by nearly 20 percentage points. Internal polls for the Flanagan campaign had shown her ahead, though not by such a large margin. But a public poll published a week earlier had put Ms. Craig ahead by 2 points. That poll was commissioned by a Minnesota TV network, suggesting that independent polls in primaries aren't necessarily more reliable. And again, this particular article was by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to join me and listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I will be back with you next week with more from the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you for listening.